This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of a GHIL lecture by David Milne, Professor of Modern History at the University of East Anglia, on Siegfried Schulz, the Chicago Tribune and the Third Reich. For journalist William Shirer, quote, no other correspondent in Germany knew so much of what was going on behind the scenes as did Siegfried Schulz, unquote. Hermann Göring denounced Schulz as, quote, that dragon lady from Chicago, unquote. Siegfried Schulz lived in Berlin from 1914 to 1941, was bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune from 1925, and had a formidable record of journalistic accomplishment. Yet, Schulz has left only a faint historical trace. Schulz overcame significant obstacles as a woman in a male-dominated milieu, as a foreign journalist working in a totalitarian state, and as an interventionist at an isolationist newspaper throughout her career. This lecture explores Schulz's work and her significance.
Well, thank you so much for that really kind introduction. And as your introductory remarks make clear, I'm first and foremost a historian of U.S. foreign policy. That's what I've researched. That's what I've published in the past. And so this project is something of a sabbatical from the history of U.S. foreign relations. It's required me to engage deeply in an area I'd not really engaged with before, the history of interwar Germany, of course. And I'm very much, I would regard myself very much as a novice. The imposter syndrome that I'm feeling right now at the German Historical Institute is profound. I'd also say this is not a book talk. The book has not been completed yet, much to my editor's chagrin. So sorry, Susan. This book is under contract with Oxford University Press. It's probably a few years away from publication. So it's nice to have an early opportunity to put some of the ideas out there and to get some feedback on those. Okay, I should probably explain first how I came to work on Siegfried Schulz. As I said, U.S. foreign relations is my principal focus, and I'm really interested in the connections between ideas, intellectuals, and policymaking through the course of the 20th century. In the second book I published, Worldmaking, I wrote a chapter on George Kennan, the diplomat who authored the containment strategy that was so instrumental in guiding US foreign policy towards the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. Kennan had been based at the US Embassy in Berlin from 1939 to 1941, and he was interned along with every other American living in Germany following Hitler's declaration of war on the United States. Now, in my research on George Kennan's unhappy experience of internment, now it was unhappy because he was forced to live in close quarters with many of his fellow Americans, which I don't know if any of you know much about George Kennan, but that's a sort of a living hell for him. But it was a bad experience. But anyway, through the research, I happened upon an excellent book by Andrew Nagorsky titled Hitlerland: American Eyewitnesses to the Nazi Rise to Power. And a compelling, interesting figure who recurs throughout the book is Siegfried Schulz, the Chicago Tribune's bureau chief for Central Europe, a resourceful journalist who lived in Berlin from 1914 to 1941. Intrigued, I sought out Schulz elsewhere and found that she also pops up sporadically in a very popular book, Eric Larson's In the Garden of Beasts, which focuses on the experiences of Ambassador William Dodd and his family in Berlin in the 1930s. And sufficiently encouraged by what I had read, I made a trip to Madison, Wisconsin, where Schulz's papers are based. 51 archive boxes of Schulz material, which is a substantial amount of material to process, but there was enough in there that suggested to me that this has the makings of a book, potentially, which is why I moved on to this project. So what did I learn from that first trip to Madison and from some of the secondary research that I completed? Well, a passport photo here dates from 1914. The press pass on the right is from 1938. And here's some highlights. So Schultz interviewed embittered German nationalists, including General Erich Ludendorff, in the aftermath of the First World War. In late 1925, she became the bureau chief for a major U.S. newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, only the second woman, weeks after Dorothy Thompson, to do so. Schultz covered the rise and fall of Weimar Germany and forged an important working relationship with its best-known politician, Gustav Stresemann. Anticipating the future significance of Nazism as a political force, she strategically befriended Hermann Göring and secured an interview with Adolf Hitler in 1931. Working for an isolationist newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, and editor Robert R. McCormick, Schultz filed copy that was critical of the Nazi regime, but never to the point that she was ejected from the country. And that was always a tricky line to navigate living in Germany at that time. Schultz scored a major scoop in 1939 when she broke the story of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. In 1940, she was hit by shrapnel during a British bombing raid on Berlin, which later caused her to leave Germany. Ill health and the onset of war with the United States ensured she didn't return until D-Day, after which she reported from the aftermath of the Battle of the Bulge and the liberation of Buchenwald. She reported from the early stages of the Nuremberg trials and spoke with Göring before his death by suicide. So you can see, you know, that sequence of experiences, of interviews, you know, was certainly a compelling one as I sort of started to, you know, dot everything together. And it gives you some sense of Schultz's significance as a journalist and as an eyewitness to history. What I'd like to do in the remainder of the lecture is to flesh out this career and consider the three principal challenges that she confronted as a journalist in Nazi Germany. Firstly, that she was a woman in a male dominated industry and milieu. Secondly, that she worked in a totalitarian state that was highly sensitive to press criticism. And finally, that she worked for a newspaper, the Tribune, not naturally inclined to publish stories that might encourage interventionist sentiment in the United States. For someone who was hostile to Nazism from the movement's earliest days, these were daunting challenges indeed. So Sigrid Lillian Schultz was born in Chicago in 1893. Her father, Hermann Schultz, was a Norwegian portrait painter of relatively humble origins. Her mother, Hedwig Jaskiewicz, was from a prominent musical family of mixed lineage, German, Russian, Polish, French, who had resided for many generations in Wiesbaden. It was the lure of the Chicago World's Fair that had brought Hermann and Hedwig Schultz to the American Midwest. Hermann had been commissioned to paint a portrait of Mayor Carter Harrison, and for a while, the family thrived in Chicago. So I have some photos. It's always, I feel good when you're presenting a talk to have photos of large dogs. I have some of these. This is Sigrid's father, Hermann, Barry, the St. Bernard. This is a particularly good photo, I feel, with Barry in the foreground. And here's a portrait of Sigrid Schultz as painted by her father at around about age 15. They left Chicago when Sigrid was 7. They moved first to Wiesbaden, then to Paris, and then finally to Berlin, where the family settled in 1914. Along the way, Sigrid became fluent in French and German, attending classes at the Sorbonne, and later at the University of Berlin. And this is a photo of young Sigrid and her mother, taken by her father. Now, unfortunately, mother and daughter were marooned in Berlin when the US declared war on Germany in 1917. Schultz and her mother were classified as enemy aliens and were compelled to report daily to the German authorities. They were also denied travel privileges, which meant an enforced separation from Hermann, who was stranded in Munich. Schultz and her mother experienced the acute food shortages imposed by Great Britain's naval blockade. The two women bred rabbits that they used in barter deals for other foodstuffs. To make ends meet, Sigrid served as an English tutor to wealthy German families. She effectively became the family breadwinner. She also experienced tragedy when her Norwegian fiancé drowned at sea when a German U-boat sunk the ship on which he was traveling. It was at the end of the war that Schultz got her big break through Richard Henry Little, the Chicago Tribune's lead journalist in Berlin and a friend of her father from their Chicago days. Schultz became first a translator and then, soon after, a cub reporter for the Tribune. One of her first assignments, as I had mentioned before, was to interview General Ludendorff, the joint leader of Germany's war effort with Paul von Hindenburg. The interview went badly. Ludendorff ended early, affronted by what he took to be Schultz's insufficiently respectful style. She soon, though, got the hang of interviewing grandiose and powerful men. She had to, as a reporter for the Tribune. And she became a skilled, accomplished reporter in very little time. She was a clear writer. Her German was excellent, unlike so many of the American correspondents living in Berlin in the interwar years, and she accumulated a very large circle of contacts. The Tribune appointed her bureau chief for Central Europe in 1925, as I mentioned. Now, I want to just briefly pause just to talk a little bit about the history of women in US journalism. I'd highly recommend these two books by Alice Faz and Julia Guarneri, both published in the last 7 or 8 years. The late 19th and early 20th centuries witnessed a huge expansion in the newspaper industry in the United States. As Guarneri writes, quote, whereas the country's existing daily newspapers had printed fewer than one copy for every two U.S. households in 1880, they printed 1.5 copies for every household by 1915. In 1880, urban daily papers had run to about 12 pages. By 1930, those papers would run perhaps 40 or 60 pages, with their Sunday editions topping 100, end quote. Millions of American women picked up the newspaper reading habit during this time, and census figures demonstrate that increasing numbers of women became journalists. In 1870, only 35 women were recorded to be working as editors and reporters in the United States. In 1880, this number rose to 288. In 1890, 888, and in 1900, there were nearly 2,200 women out of an admittedly huge 30,000 total journalists in the United States. But this demonstrates an upwards curve. Women, though, generally were sharply constrained as to which sections of the newspapers they were permitted to work in. As Alice Faz writes, quote, most women began their newspaper careers in some way connected to the women's page, one of only two departments of the newspaper where women could rise to editorships. The other department managed the new Sunday sections of many newspapers. Women were able to become Sunday editors there in part because these sections contained women's pages, society pages, all features assigned to women, end quote. Now, this full-page advertisement from the Chicago Tribune in 1938 serves to illustrate this point. We have Mary Mead, the home economics editor, India Moffat, the society editor, Bettina Bedwell, Paris fashion correspondent, Ree Seeger, Chicago fashion editor, and Mae Tinney, motion picture critic. Sigrid Schultz's job title, Chief Berlin Bureau, does set her apart. Female journalists had, of course, written on foreign affairs in the past, but these tended to be on a per-piece basis. Margaret Fuller covered the Italian uprisings of 1848 for the New York Tribune. In the late 19th century, Nellie Bly wrote on Mexican affairs occasionally for the Pittsburgh Dispatch. Margaret Sullivan covered European affairs for the Associated Press. And as we move into the early 20th century, Mary Boyle O'Reilly, in Belgium at the time of the German invasion in 1914, wrote stories for the Boston Pilot. But these women were generally rarities in a male-dominated profession. And this second full-page advertisement from the Tribune serves to illustrate this point. It lists the Tribune's foreign correspondents and bureau chiefs in 1939, everyone a man except front and center, Sigrid Schultz. Again, as I mentioned, in this period, there are women making inroads here. Through the 1920s and 30s, Janet Flanner, wrote for The New Yorker, Martha Gellhorn, famously from various locations for Collier's, and Margaret Bourke White for Life magazine. But there should be no doubt that journalism was overwhelmingly a male domain in the 1920s and 30s, and Schultz had to find a way to navigate it. As she herself recalled, quote, "It was not always easy to convince the Germans of that time that a woman could be the boss of a big outfit, comparatively big, as correspondence offices go." Nonetheless, as Schultz recalled, quote, "Chancellor and Foreign Minister Stresemann, Chancellor Brüning, and the various men at the helm of the German government managed to ignore old-time prejudices," end quote. Now, some of this can be attributed to simple practicality. Based on its circulation, advertising revenues, and political clout, the Chicago Tribune described itself as, quote, "the world's greatest newspaper," end quote, on its masthead. This was hyperbole, but it was one of the three most important newspapers in the United States at that time. There's a quote from a reporter from the Chicago Daily News, John Gunther, that helps place the Tribune or describe the Tribune fairly vividly. "What the Chicago Tribune reminds me of most," writes or remembered Gunther, "is the state of Texas. Like Texas, it's aggressive, sensitive in the extreme, loaded with guts and braggadocio, expansionist and medieval." That's harsh. "Also like Texas, it has its own foreign policy, the one very different." So what Gunther was referring to here was the political proclivities of the Tribune's owner, Robert R. McCormick, who was an instinctive isolationist, for want of a better term, certainly an anti-Wilsonian, and vehemently opposed to Franklin Roosevelt's presidency. In the 1920s and early 1930s, Germany's political class had to take the Tribune and its bureau chief seriously. How could it not, given its clout? Even then, though, there were obstacles to clear. At the National Association of German Industry's annual banquet in 1926, for example, Schultz was literally the only woman in the room. Once she got in, that was. At the door, Schultz was denied entry to the men-only, male-only gathering. She insisted she speak with the press chief of the association, handed him her card and scribbled on it, quote, "are 300 men afraid of one woman," end quote. She was ushered to a table, sat down for dinner, and, as Schultz remembers, quote, "as the banquet progressed, I saw the moguls grin as my card was passed from hand to hand. One after the other, they came round to talk to me and show they were not scared of one lone woman." Okay, so the heart of Schultz's journalistic operation was the Adlon, one of Berlin's grandest hotels, where the Tribune had a suite of offices. Its guest room served as a temporary home for distinguished visitors, while its bar was a permanent meeting point for the city's foreign press corps. The ambience, as Schultz remembered, was incredible. Whether bullets were whizzing by it, as Schultz recalls, a hungry mob was threatening it, whether world-famous statesmen were in conference or at banquets, whether the would-be elite were dancing all night, or whether black marketeers or political plotters were at work. Schultz spent a lot of time in the Adlon Bar, as a place where contacts could be made and stories potentially broken. But this was a hard-drinking male milieu. And, to quote Schultz, "I could not risk having the boys beat me to a scoop just because I would not go into the bar." Schultz's solution was simple. She made an agreement with the bar's staff that, quote, "whenever I asked for a Schultz cocktail, they would give me a very wicked concoction and a tiny glass. It was only orange juice with a drop of something stronger to make it look a bit more like a cocktail," end quote. With this arrangement in place, Schultz stayed up later with greater command of her faculties than many other of the individuals in that bar. Finally, Schultz became a manager of men, which riled some and exacerbated insecurities. "We had a big organization all over Central Europe," Schultz recalled, "and it may have been quite a shock to some of the men to discover themselves under the orders of a woman," end quote. There was also a deeply entrenched drinking culture that she worked assiduously to dilute. To quote Schultz, "I did not care how drunk they got after office hours, but I insisted on accurate reporting, and they did not care much for that." Worse was to come when the Tribune insisted that Schultz fire some of her staff, a task she understandably approached with dread. When she informed her first staff member that he was out of a job, quote, "I was staggered to see him burst into tears and beg for a second try. It was hard enough for a man to handle a woman who cries, but what does a woman do in sight of tears like this?" Schultz's answer was to give him, quote, "a second, a third, a fourth chance," end quote, until she could stand it no more. gender challenges, obstacles then were clear and present and had to be surmounted. But what's the second impediment to Schultz reporting freely that she was based in a totalitarian state? Now, that the Nazi authorities were sensitive to foreign criticism was demonstrated when Dorothy Thompson was ejected from Germany in 1934. Thompson had famously derided Hitler as, quote, the very prototype of the little man. This is probably a quote that many of you will recognize. And Thompson did not hold back in expressing contempt for Hitler once he acquired power. She editorialized. She didn't just report. In other words, where Thompson had viewed Hitler as underwhelming, as vaguely comic, when she interviewed him in 1931, Schultz, who also interviewed him that same year, perceived him as a more genuine threat. And it remained a source of pride to Schultz throughout her career that her reading was ultimately correct and Thompson's was wrong. Yet Schultz was as opposed to Nazism as Thompson, yet she escaped expulsion. How did she do it? Well, firstly, as mentioned before, the Nazi press authorities well understood how useful the Chicago Tribune, isolationist, sympathetic to the view that the Versailles Treaty had roused justified German resentments. This made it useful to the cause. Keeping the Tribune's bureau chief in Germany, so long as she avoided the type of editorializing that Thompson indulged in this piece that was published in Cosmopolitan, was viewed as the preferable course. Here in this photo from 1934, you can see Schultz with Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda chief, and Ambassador William Dodd at the Foreign Press Ball. They're enjoying a light moment here, which would have gladdened Schultz, for keeping Goebbels on side was important. She also made an important, very important contact in Hermann Göring, best known as Supreme Commander of the Luftwaffe from 1935 to 1945, but an individual who held many important positions in the Nazi Party before and after Hitler rose to power. In 1930, Schultz identified Göring as an important figure in the party and, quote, auditioned him in a Berlin restaurant, concluding that, quote, he had the kind of table manners that one could invite to lunch, end quote. Thereafter, Göring was a frequent invitee to dinner parties that Sigrid and her mother hosted in their Berlin apartment. As Schultz recalled later, quote, feeding the gentleman very well was very useful as a means to get information out of him, end quote. It was through Göring that she secured an interview with Hitler in 1931. In spite of being well connected with high-placed Nazis, the relationship between Schultz and the Third Reich, though, was never going to remain entirely amicable. Schultz reported factually and dispassionately, but what she wrote could not fail to horrify her readers back in Chicago and beyond. And in doing so, this flagged her as a threat. To kind of overcome this, she, or to publish in more unvarnished form, she employed a different tack. She filed stories under fictitious name John Dixon and wired those to Chicago from other neighboring countries. In 1938 and 1939, a series of hard-hitting articles appeared on the Tribune's front page alongside a series published in the Tribune's graphic magazine titled, quote, The Truth About Nazi Germany, end quote. The first articles appearing in August and September 1938 focused on the concentration camps, the persecution of Jews, secret arrests, labor conscription, and the attacks on churches, on the church generally. On July 13th, 1939, the most remarkable Dixon article of them all appeared on the Tribune's front page, moving into the newspaper proper. It forecast the Nazi-Soviet pact, which at the time was being secretly negotiated. As Schultz, as Dixon wrote, the newest toast in high Hitler Guard circles is to our secret ally, Russia. Supporters of the theory of Nazi-Soviet cooperation claim that plans for a new partition of Poland, dividing it between Germany and Russia, have been concluded, end quote. Schultz was correct, and you'll notice from the paper that the lead was buried midway through the article. 40 days later, on August 23rd of 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was announced. Now, the quality and prescience of her reporting from Nazi Germany was impressive. How did she accomplish it? From where and from whom did Schultz acquire her information? The journalist William Shirer observed that, quote, no other American correspondent knew so much of what was going on behind the scenes as Sigrid Schultz. She knew literally everybody, end quote. Her friend and Berlin contemporary Benjamin Ziemer later wrote, where Sigrid got her news tips, nobody ever really knew for sure, from friends among the German nobility, political leaders, churchmen, government officials, labor leaders, educators. She knew more people in more walks of life than any two journalists put together. From analyzing all the leading German newspapers daily, from informants she hired, from guests in her home. More generally, sheer instinct seemed to point her in the right direction. And this is the part of Schultz's life that I'm intrigued to research in more detail. There's a fascinating story to tell here on journalistic method, the compromises one must make, the subterfuges one must employ while working inside a totalitarian state. Finally, I'd like to turn to Schultz's relationship with her employer, the Chicago Tribune, and its anti-interventionist owner and publisher. Robert McCormick was one of the most powerful newspaper owners of the 20th century. The length of Schultz's career at the Tribune depended in no small part on how she managed relations with McCormick. A cold, rather aloof man who, in spite of his pronounced Anglophobia, looked like he belonged in the English aristocracy. In this regard, and in so many others, she managed him very well indeed. It wasn't all plain sailing. In early 1934, McCormick traveled to what had recently become Nazi Germany. He gazed in admiration at a march of stormtroopers. Schultz recalled that, quote, I was sitting beside the colonel, and I could see his soldiers' heart throbbing. The way they marched was just absolutely beautiful. To snap him out of his reverie, Schultz pointed out Ernst Röhm and added, the quote, the little man there beside him is his former lover, and his other lover, the new one, is standing right behind, end quote. McCormick was scandalized and complained to staff at the US embassy later that, quote, Schultz is terrible, end quote. He only settled down a little later after staff at the embassy verified that what Schultz had said was true. This was a rare misstep, however. Schultz managed the close and regular correspondence with McCormick through the 1930s and continued to impress him with the acuity of her appraisals of German politics. McCormick trusted Schultz and published what she wrote, even when it encouraged a sense of outrage amongst the Tribune's readers that he, an isolationist, a friend of Charles Lindbergh, could do well without. So, you know, McCormick, in terms of the editorial position of the newspaper, it was implacably anti-interventionist. In regards to the journalism that he published from Schultz, he generally published what she submitted, regardless of how it might have jarred with the editorial line. A page like this, published in the Tribune, is testament to Schultz's skill and persistence. You can see the headline, When Liberty Dies. Now, moving forward to August 25th, 1948, in retaliation for a German bombing raid that affected London, the RAF bombed Berlin for the first time. Sigrid Schultz was delighted that the British had exposed German vulnerability, but she was hit by a piece of shrapnel that evening just prior to her delivering a radio broadcast for Mutual Broadcasting. So in addition to her journalism, like so many individuals of that period, including William Shirer, she delivered radio broadcasts back to the United States for the Mutual Broadcasting Corporation. She remained in Berlin for just a few more months, but decided at the end of the year to return home to the United States to take a much-needed break and check in with her mother, whom she had resettled in Westport, Connecticut in 1938. Unfortunately, she contracted typhus along the way, and her recovery from the disease, which was so often fatal, was slow. In August 1941, still, quote, weak as a pup from the typhus, Schultz asked Robert McCormick if she might return to Berlin. He refused, noting that she should, quote, postpone her return temporarily until tension is lessened, end quote. Tension ran in the opposite direction in the months to come, which meant that Schultz would remain firmly put in the United States. And like many foreign correspondents of that time, she embarked on a nationwide speaking tour that was massively successful. The crowds that she drew, the audiences, were really substantial. She was able to live fairly well in the post-war period in the United States, largely as a consequence of the fees that she generated on the speaking tour in 1942, 1943. Like other correspondents, she also published a book published in 1944 titled Germany Will Try It Again. The clue is definitely in the title, with this book, which contended that Germany, following its inevitable defeat, would return to its militaristic expansionist ways. And she remained true to this belief that Germany could not be trusted, that it would always represent a threat, all the way to her death in 1980. After returning to mainland Europe following the D-Day invasion in the summer of 1944, Schultz accompanied the 1st and 3rd armies through France and Belgium as they marched towards Germany. In April 1945, she took a detour to Weimar and became one of the first journalists, alongside Edward Murrow, Margaret Bourke White, to enter the Buchenwald camp. She later travelled to the Nuremberg trials, where Schultz met again with Hermann Göring and asked him about the camps. And the same Göring, Schultz recalled, who in 1934 had boasted to me that they were good for German morale, produced the first-class baby stare. Oh, I did not know what was going on in those camps, end quote. It was Nuremberg that caused Schultz, though, to break with Robert McCormick and the Chicago Tribune. She had met with McCormick to discuss the newspaper's coverage of the Nuremberg trials. And to quote Schultz, "We had a very good talk. We talked about Nuremberg. Then the colonel said, 'We have officers who should also be put on trial,' end quote. And I gasped and I said, 'Colonel, I'm sorry, I can't go along with that.' So then we switched to normal things. Afterwards, I went down those long stairs, weeping my head off." She and the Tribune ultimately parted ways in 1946. Now, there's no story to tell of Schultz's resurgence in the period following her return to the United States in 1946 and her death in 1980. Her career slowed and then stalled as decent writing commissions petered out. The main reason? She could not forgive Germany. Her book, Germany Will Try It Again, summarised the views that she held very firmly to for the remainder of her life. As the Second World War ended and the US-Soviet Cold War began, West Germany was, of course, rehabilitated and became a vital ally to the US. Schultz pitched piece after piece, contending that Germany remained a threat, but the Soviet Union had become the United States' principal enemy by 1947. As the years passed, the notion that West Germany posed any kind of threat to the US, to the West, appeared as detached from reality, and so editors politely declined her many submissions. In Cold War America, she was simply unable to move on. She also, though, lacked the literary ability, particularly in book-length form, that William Shirer and Dorothy Thompson possessed. In short-form journalism, being a clear writer was enough for Schultz. In book form, her prose was turgid and inelegant. Journalism is, in its nature, ephemeral, and as she was unable to publish any more books on politics and international affairs, so her visibility markedly plummeted in this post-war period. Following the death of her mother in 1960, Schultz focused increasingly on writing for publications such as the Ladies Home Journal. Some of her post-war income is derived through writing cookbooks and lifestyle articles. As her acuity on foreign affairs dwindled, Schultz was forced to pick from the gendered occupational categories that she had transcended in interwar Germany. To her death in 1980, Schultz worked on a memoir and a history of anti-Semitism in Germany with a growing sense of futility that neither would see light of day. Sigrid Schultz died in 1980, aged 87. Slowly, though, Schultz has begun to receive more attention. Judith Mackrell's book, Going with the Boys, Norman DeMeyer's American Journalist in Hitler's Germany, an excellent book that I just finished reading recently. And finally, and this is an interesting cautionary tale to tell for those of you who've started a biography and then someone has then got there first. Because a year ago, a book came out titled The Dragon from Chicago by Pamela Toller, which focuses on Sigrid Schultz. And so I was saying earlier, I had this very weird experience of wishing ill on a book, desperately hoping that this book would be, would have holes in it, the research would lack depth and so on and so forth. And this is a recorded lecture. I'm not going to say anything mean about the book, but there remains things to be said I was pleased to discover after reading said book. It's also been really interesting for me focusing on a protagonist who wrote so much over such a sustained period. As I said, there's probably about maybe 45,000 pages of material in Schultz's papers in Wisconsin. I focused on her time in Berlin, as that was the, I guess, the consequential part of the career, you know, the part that, you know, is of you know, genuine historical significance. But the story of her post-war life in the United States, where this career declined ultimately, is fascinating too. And so after writing a book on Walt Rostow, one of the architects of the Vietnam War, chapters on Henry Kissinger and Paul Wolfowitz, individuals with, well, let's say checkered legacies, part of Schultz's appeal to me was as, I suppose, an appealing protagonist, you know, maybe even doing a little good in the world, you know, that type of thing. She did that. But as her papers make clear, she was incredibly wrong-headed on so many political issues of the day. And something that comes across in her papers very strongly is her sincere, deeply felt racism towards African-Americans in the post-war period. It's hard to kind of avoid that. So as a experience, as a research project, there's been a lot that's been fascinating. And this definitely won't be a hagiography. But I hope I've been able to convey some sense, at least, of where Schultz's significance lies. And thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.